You know, Ram Dass referred to, I think, the greatest compliment that Ram Dass gave him, and it wasn't an exclamation of any sort, but he said, Aldous Huxley had a very, very great relationship with the mystery. Hey everyone, it's Mind Rolling. I'm back with my original Mind Rolling partner, David Silver. David, so glad to have you back. Welcome.
It's good to be here. It really
Thank
is.
Thank you. So, in continuing this kind of offhanded series that we've been doing about Just Ask the Experts, where we talk about various people, like who do we do? Yeah. We've done Jung, for instance, and not knowing hardly anything, but we managed to come out with something that, you know, might have been slightly enlightening. Anyhow,
yeah,
today
we fell upon something, you know.
Yeah,
got
you
to
fall.
You know.
It's literally you just fall over on something or mm-hmm. other. But today we have Aldous Huxley. We want to talk about Aldous, and Aldous was extraordinarily meaningful to Ram Dass in particular. Because when he and Leary started doing those experiments in at Harvard around psychedelics, I guess that Huxley, you know, somehow they were in touch with him. And he's the one who turned them on to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was a, you know, a huge, huge, huge experience for them. It really gave them a bit of the map that eventually, of course, Ram Dass went to India to find somebody who actually could describe this map in more detail, not just the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and not just, say, just about a book like that. But so he was seminal in their march towards understanding the efficacy of ethnogens. And I found this podcast actually on Be Here Now Network, which I shared with you, David, which was Ram Dass talking about Huxley. I don't remember ever listening to it actually myself, but I must have because I did an intro to it. Sometimes they just give me notes and, you know, I don't even listen because I'm running too fast. But in this case, I was happy to hear the whole thing. It was revealing. You know what I love best, though, when he says, yeah, we were like, me and Leary, we were like the young Turks coming out. This is what, 62, something like that? Because it was after his first psilocybin experience.
Harvard Turks.
Yeah, Harvard Turk, yeah. And he got invited as a Harvard Turk to a Hollywood Hills party in Los Angeles. And at that party, Aldous Huxley and his wife, Laura. And Ram Dass just describes the awe. He was in awe of Aldous, you know. I just thinking back then and seeing those early pictures of Ram Dass, what he would look like in awe, you know, since I mostly, of course, I didn't know him then. I only knew him after his journey to India. So, yeah. Aldous.
He says, Raghu, he says in the lecture, twice, I think, how humbled he was to be asked to do this. And the way he spoke about
Yeah, which
Huxley,
was him Laura wanted him to talk about Huxley, and this was probably around 1990, David, and I kind of
I guess. He calls him an upaguru, right? Which
yeah.
is, I think you say, it's very, I never, it's interesting. It's like the guru, not the ultimate saint or mahasiddha, but a person that points the way,
yeah.
crystallizes. And he crystallized for you and now for RD and everyone. And for me, it was a different thing. Aldous Huxley, my brother and I shared a bedroom in Lancashire, in Accrington, where we grew up. And my brother was an extreme reader, you know. And when he was about 20, he read Brave New World. And I was 10. And as older brothers are sometimes do, he forced me to read it. And watched me, you know, because we had beds like 6 feet away from each other. And I read it at a very young age. And I didn't really believe that such a thing existed, that anyone could write like that, that could prophesy something. And then, you know, now all those years later, decades and decades, we are living in a society that is absolutely dominated by consumerism and productivity and that whole thing, and advertisements and propaganda and all kinds of ways of brainwashing people. So Brave New World really gave me an insight into that. Mm. Doors of Perception is a whole different thing because I came across that much later. But in the same way that he talks about, you know, this man opening up in a very, very significant way, the way he looked at the world and looked at himself. That's my experience, goes back to being 10. Now, I'm not saying I understood anything spiritual about Brave New World. I just knew that Aldous Huxley knew something that I didn't know. My parents didn't seem to know, you know, and they were pretty sharp about the way things were in a conditioned society. But Huxley was way ahead of his time.
Yeah,
and
we should.
We should go into him.
Yeah, good time, David, actually, since he's countryman to you. Maybe good time. There may be people, I'm sure there are people, because Huxley died in the mid-late 60s.
63, I think.
62. Oh, so early 60s. He died.
Yes, I think so.
Soon after Ram Dass. I know Ram Dass hung out with him a number of different times and actually was with him in London just before he died. Yeah, who is Aldous Huxley?
Well, Huxley comes from a very, very prominent English sort of sociology, scientific families. Sir Julian Huxley, I believe, was his brother. Thomas Huxley was his father. They were all extremely well respected for their scientific and societal works. And Aldous was, you know, not doing the same thing. And it was sort of inevitable that he would go in a different direction, because he talks about it frequently about the tyranny of the intellect how to tame the intellect to get to a higher, less dualistic place. And I can see why Aldous was like that, because my knowledge of Julian and Thomas is that they were the most extreme kind of intellectual analysts of evolution, of biology, of philosophy, all of that. Mm. He grew up with that. And just like Alan Watts, another fellow countryman who moved to California, similarly, Watts talks at some point about getting away from that, what Ram Dass called cold fish, stuff that people don't react very well in England, or didn't at that time, in the same way. Post-Beatles, it changed a bit. But up to the 1960s, very tight-lipped, and you just didn't talk about religion, or spirituality wasn't a word that existed there. You know? And Aldous, I mean, you can't really deconstruct his journey into writing those amazing books, Island being an astonishing book.
Last book he wrote, yeah.
Yes. And obviously Brave New World, but lots of others. And Doors of Perception, let's just get that straight, comes from a poem called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by William Blake. And actually, Aldous also wrote a book called Heaven and Hell. And
yeah.
It was based on that. And a lot of those polarities that Blake was talking about in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, what could be two more polar differences, became Aldous's sort of mantra at that time, if you like. You know, that we're just trapped in dualism. And at one point, he talked about children being a combination of dualist and non-dualist. Their natural inclination is clearly non-dualist, is the law of one, because that's all they can apprehend. But the parents instill in them a necessary, as Aldous calls it, non-dualism, in order to grow up in a human social complex and not, you know, perish. So the child is a commixture, if you like, of the two polar opposites of that. And then Aldous, after sort of pointing that out, says, well, then it's sort of lifelong struggle, because you've been necessarily told you're in a family, you're on a street, you live in this town, my father did this for a living, you're going to do that, you're going to go to this college. And you do it, and you take it in, and you believe it, and you fear it. You fear moving outside of it. And Alice Huxley, along with Wilhelm Reich and others of the previous times, obviously Henry James, were the first sort of Westerners in a way to get to this point that Raghu and I and many others that we know are involved in for our entire lives now, that of the of pursuing the mystical, you know, and mysterious and yet uplifting and motivating. Because Aldous talks about that too, about if we can hang on to what we perceive and what we feel in a psychedelic moment. Let's put it that way. For him, it was mescaline and mushrooms. But for all of us who have ever done that, it could be any one of many things. If it doesn't kill us and make us crazy, which it doesn't usually, very rare, it moves us and shifts us. The trick then is to be able to incorporate that, infuse that into one's everyday exact experience with other humans, pets, animals, media, problems, confrontations, so forth.
Yeah.
And no question about it, Raghu. You brought it up a couple of weeks ago to me, and I was sort of, well, I read that when I was like a kid. And I was a bit, you know, but that's stupid because he really is one of the, you know, originators of this mode of not perceiving, of being.
Yeah.
So that Ram Dass is a natural, a complete corollary of that in our experiences.
Yeah.
Meaning the end, not a parallel, but the end product for Westerners of how far they could go in the time that we've lived in, the time space we've lived in. Yeah. Ram Dass is a marvelous example of that. But without Aldous and Laura Huxley, I suspect it would have taken Ram Dass longer to come to those marvelous.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely seminal. You know, Ram Dass referred to, I think, the greatest compliment that Ram Dass gave him, and it wasn't an exclamation of any sort, but he said, Aldous Huxley had a very, very great relationship with the mystery.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
This is something Roshi Joan Halifax talks about that a lot. Whenever we've had, just sitting around the table in the days when Ram Dass was still alive in Maui, and talked about, yeah, we got to get friendly with the mystery, meaning with what we have no idea about. We have little inclinations. Psychedelics certainly give you a little bit of that. And extreme circumstances give you a little of that. Being near death gives you a lot of that. But yeah, no, I love that. He said he was always connected to his inner being. Aldous. But here's something from Doors of Perception that relates and really kind of spells out what you were saying in terms of him coming from this extraordinary intellectual family, scientists and so on. And here's what he said. Systematic reasoning is something we could not, as a species or as individuals, possibly do without. To me, that's a great statement right off the bat. You know, it doesn't, you know, through his extraordinary, I keep using this word, you know, Aldous Huxley, by the way, Ram Dass told me at one point that when he was with him, and especially when he's getting towards the end, he couldn't really speak more than he was in awe. He would go, extraordinary. He'd see everything extraordinary. Or he'd go, well, curious. Very curious. Or he'd go, how odd. That's all he could speak to towards the end. When I think he took acid and he actually died, I think.
You remember Lowell George?
Yeah.
Lowell was a good friend of mine, stayed with me in Cambridge when he came to play there. It's been Little Feet.
Yeah.
And one time he told me that he used to spend a lot of time with Aldous when he was about 16. Yes. They lived near each other, and Lowell's Lowell had a lot of suffering in his life, and it didn't end that wonderfully, but bless him, he was a marvelous musician and a lovely guy. And he said that Huxley really influenced his later teenage life and was very important in his life.
Wow, that's
and anybody who sort of came across Lowell's music was in awe. I was. I just thought he was spectacular, wonderful musician. Yeah. And so, you know, it's amazing how people get affected, all kinds of different people. And yet, someone like Aldous Huxley is certainly, you know, seminal.
Yeah.
He's seminal in this. It would be really false to say that. I mean, you have to say, well, Viva Kanata came to America and then came to England and everything and all this, and Yogananda and all this. But for the thing to really become more multidimensionally immediately with Westerners, you needed a Westerner to talk to.
Exactly. To talk about, you know, the way that we are addicted to our minds. So again, I want to read this thing. Systematic reasoning is something we could not as a species or as individuals possibly do without. But neither, if we are to remain sane, can we possibly do without direct perception. The more unsystematic, the better, of the inner and outer worlds into which we have been born. This given reality is an infinite which passes all understanding and yet admits of being directly and in some sort totally apprehended. It's a transcendence belonging to another order than the human. And yet it may be present to us as a felt immanence, an experienced participation. To be enlightened is to be aware always of total reality in its imminent otherness, to be aware of it, and yet to remain in a condition to survive as an animal, to think and feel as a human being, to resort whatever expedient to systematic reasoning. Our goal is to discover that we have always been where we ought to be. Mm. Isn't that great? I mean,
can't argue with that.
No.
Not a word of it, you know. He also talks, I think, rather well about the fear that creeps in when anyone, either with a psychedelic or without, a mystical moment or whatever, you know. Let me find that because it's much more succinct than anything I could say. Hang on, just one second. Sorry.
While you're looking, I just hark back to the reality again. As you mentioned it more than once, of who he is to us, especially, you know, the seekers from our age, late 60s, 70s on. And now, and that's why I thought, wouldn't this be great to introduce Aldous to people who have not experienced him before? Because he carries that just amazing relationship to mind and spirit. Mm. You know, how he really speaks to when he says, we can't lose reason. Same as the Buddhists. His Dalai Lama says, unless you've got to use your mind to go beyond it and into Buddha mind, you've got to have direct experience, which is what he just said, Huxley.
Yes.
So he's an important figure and worthwhile investigating.
Yeah, and he's a joy to read his books. I mean, it's not like hard. He's really.
Yeah, right.
I was going to say this is what the quote is about fear, and it's particularly involved in transcendent. Or a transcendental moment of realization or perception. So he says, with or without a psychedelic, he says, the fear, as I analyze it in retrospect, was of being overwhelmed, of disintegrating under a pressure of reality greater than a mind accustomed to living most of the time in a cozy world of symbols could possibly bear. And I must say that in my early experiences with psychedelics in the late 60s, there were moments, no question about it, when for whatever reason, whether it was environmental or not the right setting or whatever, when I would lose all ground. And the feeling of losing all ground is one of those sort of almost mythic, heroic things that you have to go through in yourself to suddenly find yourself beyond that in a place of peace and intense realization of the present. And when it comes on you in the use of a psychedelic, for instance, it is really fast. It might take 45 minutes to actually realize the effect of the substance. But when it actually comes, it hits you very quickly, the whole thing, and then it develops bigger as you go into it. And I remember, the fear, the first time I did that, wouldn't go away. And then the room I was in had an aquarium with all kinds of beautiful fish, small fish in it. And I wandered over to it, and they had to drag me away from it. Not because like the usual sort of, stereotype, acid, pothead type of thing. Oh, you stare at stuff, you're like stupid. On the contrary, when I was staring at these goldfish and various other forms of small fish, I just thought they were so intensely beautiful and emotionally there. In other words, I didn't just see them as some sort of, okay, they're fish, you know. I can't think about them, they can't think about a sort of separation. That went, and I was floating around that aquarium like a fish, and I've been doing that ever since.
Cool.
Really.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, I'm serious. Yeah. I'm still floating around there trying to understand what is actually the, you know, you mentioned the infinite and eternal, you know, those two things that Aldous Huxley wanted to make in other writings, I noticed, he wanted to sort of break down the trap, you know, that we all feel comfortable. And Pema Chodron has spoken extremely eloquently about, the safety zone, the cozy place, the comfort zone, which is nice. Many people in the world, hell, would love to have a bit of that, and I'd love them to have it. But if you just don't want to ever leave it, because, and I've met many people who say this, I don't want to know about that stuff. I don't want to go there. And you wonder, well, how could they not, really? I mean, here we are for a short time, flick of time, boom, 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 and then next. And this time, we can enjoy being a mystery, but what people like Huxley and Reich and those people said was, you know, let's try and extend it into our actual present reality. That's hard, but it happens. I don't know whether I'm going anywhere with that, but, you know, hell, I remember being groundless. And your whole life, you're basically grounded. You know, you walk out of your house, it's snowing, it's snow comes on you, it's wet, you wait for the car to come to pick you up, to get in the car, you drive. It's all very solid and cozy, but that other world isn't really that exact thing, is it? It encloses that thing, it incorporates that thing, but it is not that thing in the eternal or infinite intelligence and soul of the universe. It's just one thing, it's just one thing.
So, everybody, you know, doors of perception, of course. Huxley describes his experience with mescaline, derived from peyote plants, synthesized too. And that became a fulcrum for him to understand some of the concepts that he was curious about in his life. So, this book, it just perfectly encapsulates that period for him. That's it's a good read for anybody.
It's not that long either. It's 200 pages, I think, tops, something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, the edition I have includes the short book he did called Heaven and Hell, which you mentioned before. They have it both in one thing at this point.
You know, and something that is germane to what you just said, he says, see if this sort of fits. Every individual is at once the beneficiary and the victim of the linguistic tradition into which he or she has been born. The beneficiary, in as much as language gives access to the accumulated records of other people's experience, the victim, insofar as it confirms him in the belief the reduced awareness is the only awareness, and as it bedevils his sense of reality, so that he is all too apt to take his concepts for data, his words for actual things. I think he's very focused on this thing of the constructs that we're sort of immersed in, and sometimes we're shocked out of, but those constructs are what he's talking about. They're linguistic as well as symbolic. They're words and concepts that come from words.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that Julian Huxley and Thomas Huxley were intensely involved in Darwinian thought, you know, great. I mean, evolution's a pretty, you know, deep matter, and it's interesting, and it's great. But again, Huxley's saying, well, yeah, it was just a moment, and then there's something else, and then something else, and then there's something that's a mystery to us, and we can never use words to describe it. Or as his other Englishman said, T.S. Eliot said,
he had all these Englishmen, they're all...
Yeah, we're good.
Why there's so many damn Englishmen?
Real smart. No, the real truth is that Eliot said shanty, shanty, shanty at the end of his most famous poem. And one wonders, where did that come from? You know, and it was basically saying the words beyond words, the ineffable thing we want to realize, but as soon as we verbalize it, sometimes at any rate, it can reduce it. So teaching it is why people, I'm not going to say people like Ram Dass, there's no one like Ram Dass, but people like Huxley, Ram Dass, those sort of teachers and, you know, help us. That's what they do. They guide us through this weird, strange hinterland between the cozy reality that we've been taught to love and respect and work towards. A mortgage,
yeah,
you know, yeah. A good school for the kids, you know, a new car that's got better technology, definitely a better smart TV.
I
think about those things, and I'm 112 years old. I mean, come on,
really?
Yeah, I'm quite old. Yeah, quite old.
I love this part too that he talks about. The mescaline experience, he says, is what Catholic theologians call, quote unquote, a gratuitous grace.
That's great. That's
not necessary to salvation, but potentially helpful and to be accepted thankfully if made available. To be shaken out of the ruts of ordinary perception, to be shown for a few timeless hours the outer and inner world, not as they appear to an animal obsessed with survival, to a human obsessed with words and notions, but as they are apprehended directly and unconditionally by mind at large. This is an experience of inestimable value to everyone, and especially to the intellectual. That's a core thing of what he's about, what happened to him.
Definitely.
And, you know, how about we go back to Ram Dass first getting to India, looking for the map of consciousness, driving around, you know, in the Volkswagen van or what? No, it was a nicer car. He had a beautiful Land Rover, actually.
Oh, yeah. Better.
Much better. So... eventually, of course, Neem Karoli Baba said to him, can I have some of your medicine? And, of course, he said, I've got some aspirin. You know, what, you have a headache or what's going on? And he looked at him and said, no, the yogi medicine. So that gave Ram Dass the clue, shit, he's talking about acid. And Ram Dass had some really strong and white lightning from that time. We found out later it's, you know, it's 500-600 micrograms, which is a huge, huge dose.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, pure acid.
Yeah.
And he took a few of them and popped them in and nothing happened. And, you know, that's that whole famous, famous Ram Dass story. Mm. And basically he said exactly what Huxley is saying here. Mm. He said, this is good for beginners. It allows you to have darshan, meaning be in the presence of Christ for a few hours, but then you got to come down. Mm. This is exactly, and I'm reading this and I'm going, wow, you know, this is exactly how he's saying it. Gratuitous grace. That's kind of what that, Ram Dass used to later refer to it in a similar way. It's not the thing, but it points to the thing, the truth, shall we say. And it's not necessary to salvation, but potentially helpful and to be accepted, thankfully, if made available. And by the way, this isn't a podcast in support of everyone getting out there and taking psychedelics. Obviously, we know today what's going on, especially with all of this research and that MAPS, that organization that's forwarded the getting the government to allow psilocybin and particularly MDMA. Rick Doblin is at the head of MAPS. I could never say their name is impossible, but it is all about proving that these psychedelics are extraordinarily helpful with PTSD, addiction, death, and dying. And look where we are today. You know, he says later in the book, you know, these things are not available. The government's cut it off and it's all gone underground, which creates other issues, not just around, I mean, the illegality creates issues of paranoia because you're worried about getting busted with holding on to these things. Now, today, that seems to be, for the most part, transformed, although they have not given them. They're supposed to this summer, by the way, David. They're supposed to get MDMA approved by the feds so that they'll be able to be prescribed for people going through therapy. So, it's all being proven out and how efficacious these substances can be, but they have to be taken. And then you go all the way back to Ram Dass and Leary, how they said this is all about honoring taking these substances. It's set and setting, intention, all of that. So now we're kind of going back to that is the atmosphere that needs to be created. So anybody even thinking about this,
yes,
it has to be under those kinds of conditions. Otherwise, you know, otherwise you're just getting stoned.
I sense that the generation that is getting into this now, much younger than us, they have really gained from the kind of rather slapdash wisdom of the 60s and 70s, because it was competing with all kinds of other stuff at that time, and people didn't take it as seriously and thought it was craziness and everything. And now when I read things online or whatever, I learned that a lot of people under 30, people under 20, plus the PTSD, people who are being tremendously helped and guided by the use of this, you know, they just know a lot more than we did, I think, personally, about how to deal with all this. Of course, there are going to be extremes on the outside of that. People who take drugs, you know, in terrible ways and hurt themselves. And Raghu and I have always said that's not what we're talking about. When you come to these wonderful, amazing discoveries that were made, that a person who was in Afghanistan who was completely freaked out and no therapy, normal therapy was helping, did some microdosing and with guidance, and began to see the light, and these people are now able to articulate that, you know. And you see on even sort of rather, you know, mass market television shows now, talk shows. I've seen interviews with on the subject a lot, whereas in our day, as it were, as if it belonged to us, there was none of that. It was just, you know, Art Linkletter saying that it would be, you know, that people taking acid would jump out of buildings. Well, people jumped out of buildings because they lost their money in 1931. So, I mean, stop. But we knew it was okay if it was done right. I mean, now people are much more, I think, much more educated, not only about that, but about many things. It's easy to say, you know, that things keep getting repeated and repeated and repeated. I don't believe that. I think there's evolution now about these matters. I really do. Yeah. And I'm glad, because it's one of the things that will help save the planet. Because, you know, they are integrating, shall we say, psychedelic awareness and depth with environmentalism, with animal empathy, with all kinds of other things that fit into the vision of those substances.
Yeah.
And in a way that is remarkable. And if those things can be crystallized, if you like, which they are being just in individuals who are reacting to adverse circumstances on the planet right now. There's a lot of resistance from all kinds of young people who are doing all kinds of things that are not just about taking substances to get high. There is that, of course, but there's also a mixture of benign trajectories on the part of the action of young people these days. So we don't like, we had it in a very riotous kind of way. We would go to Washington and say, you know, stop the Pentagon from working. But of course, we couldn't. It was madness, really. But it was just a symbol. Now people are much more organized. But to get back to
Go to Pentagon and protest. At least we didn't break down the doors of
never considered Congress. Nobody did it on January 6th in those days. But that's another part of these polarities that Huxley and the great wise ones talk about to us all the time.
Yeah.
That we're you know, everybody says, well, we're in the Kali Yuga. Well, we're not in the Kali Yuga. Let's not get there. We've left that. We're in the, what is it, Dwapara Yuga, but we're in what they call Asanti. And the Sandi is the period of transition between a dark age and a light age.
Mm.
And that's what the great rishis said a million years ago, you know. And right now, it's very hard to live on this planet in some ways. But on another level, we are making tremendous progress. And I think that the Huxleys, Laura and Aldous are the only Huxleys, you know. Laura was amazingly lucid and funny, too. I never met her, but I saw her on TV. And she was incredible. What a gift.
Yes.
Can we just get into another couple of quotes from...
Well, you know what I want to do first?
What do you want to do?
It's good. We're running out.
Yeah. I mean, we're running out of time. Come on. We haven't started on this yet.
Yeah, I know. But can we not? Because you started referring to these times that we are in many different ways. And in the middle, I found this fascinating. But in the middle of this talk by Ram Dass about Huxley.
Yeah.
He responded to he spoke to the question of despair. And there's a reference here to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who David and I both are very fond of. And he was another big part of our growing up into the spiritual path, whatever you want to call it. But I want to just play this, just a couple of minutes. Here it is from Ram Dass.
And in response to this question about despair, Trungpa said, one has to stand halfway between hope and hopelessness. If one is afraid of looking at the hopeless part, one is no longer free to act in a free way because one's anxiety about the outcome colors one's perception so deeply that one is unable to experience the gestalt out of which an appropriate response occurs. That one must look at the possibility that it all turns dark and darker and darker. I remember once being in the near the temple that I'm connected with in India, in the foothills of the Himalayas, the Kamoan Hills, and visiting the ashram of a saint who had lived maybe 50, 60 years ago. Sambhari Maharaj. And when one of his devotees had asked him, he said, there will come a time when you will walk 5 miles and you will see a light, a firelight in the distance, and you'll be so happy to know another human being still is alive. This was a man who had great, great wisdom and siddhis or powers. And that image chilled me deeply. Was I really ready for Shiva's dance?
Okay, so that's it. It really is amazing. You're just talking about the question of despair. One has to stand halfway between hope and hopelessness. That's a profound thing, you know, from Trungpa. And I think that one of the thing, I mean, sort of, it closes with Ram Dass, you know, saying, referring to himself, was I really ready for Shiva's dance, Shiva, the destroyer of ignorance? Mm. And, you know, this seems to be very much, we're in the middle of this right now. So easy to fall into despair and just throw up your hands, try and go work yourself into your own private little comfort zone, as you were mentioning before. It's easy to do that. And then he had this quote, "The worst mistake is to do nothing because you can only do a little." Came from somebody named, who was that? Barkyu. Burke. I don't know which Burke, but it's some
was it the,
Burke.
The philosopher Burke? Or, yeah, it doesn't think, matter. It's yeah. Such a
anyhow,
great
but it's something that we all participate in. This is way beyond us. You know, what am I going to do? Make sure I throw the plastic and the cans in one can in one garbage can and the rest of it in another one. It's something that's part of the whole, but it's very difficult for us in these particular times. Very difficult.
I would say at this point as an interjection.
Yeah.
That if you don't want to get the blues, try and cut down on how much you watch the news. Because no matter what, if you think that's the truth, you're crazy, baby. Because that's just TV truth. It's TV truth. Some of it's true. It's not all true. And it's also not balanced, you know, anywhere. So I believe this very strongly. I'm talking about all the time these days to people and children and friends. You know, you can check out the news. Just check it out. See what they're saying. And then check out a better version of something that you found, even if it's just NPR, whatever. And check it out quickly and then go back to being yourself and doing the best you can. And if you're an activist, go back being activist. But watching the blues and getting that trapped in what, back to Huxley, it's the same thing. Linguistic, you know, tyranny. You have these people. And tonight, the news. 9,000 people, I think, thought to have died in an earthquake. And they don't know that yet. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It's depressing always. It's not, oh, what a wonderful world we live in that God has given us.
Because when you hear that, you can't tune it out either. You can't tune it out.
A little bit you can. I used to watch it all the time. I used to watch it in the morning before I meditated.
Yeah, no,
was that crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, I like Joe Scarborough and everything, but that's ridiculous. I don't want to be thinking about Joe Scarborough before I go into my meditation. I'd like to be thinking about, you know, Maharaji or Shirdi Sai Baba or some Mahasiddha. Certainly not, you know, Donald etc.
Yeah. Actually, we were in a, it's in this book, The Movie of Me to the Movie of We that Duncan Trussell and I put together. That's that there's an audio book. It's a little ad for that. Go to movieofme.com. Got a lot about what we're talking about. But in it, there's a piece from Ram Dass and somebody, it was in a session we did, in downtown LA, and he was zoomed in. It was a live thing. And somebody said, "Ram Dass, everything is just so depressing. It's so difficult to live day to day. I don't know how to handle this in relation to my life, what's going on in our world." So Ram Dass said, he said what you said, "Stop watching the news." That was his big advisal, which was funny coming from him, you know, who likes to look at the way in which a person can attend to their own self-compassion.
Yeah.
You know, but stop watching the news. That was great.
Well, you know, one's whole life these days, there are so many distractions and there's so much stress that people need to go to distractions sometimes. But when news is your entertainment, it can hurt you very badly because you can get very depressed by it because it's not, the world is messed up, but it always was. Now it's just a little more technological and nuclear. But back in the days of, you know, Jesus, I mean, how was Herod to hang out with? You know, that wasn't great, you know.
How was it to hang out with Herod? Yeah. Not good, we imagine.
No, hard. It was a challenge, Your Majesty.
Oh, God, that's so great. Yeah, you've got a couple of other, I want to point to a couple of the things from all this.
You know, you ordered me to be serious about this.
Yes,
so
I did.
I take your... okay, here's one of his non-dual statements. Each person is, at each moment, capable of remembering all that has ever happened to him or her and of perceiving everything that is happening everywhere in the universe. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, when you have these experiences, these incredible, epiphanies, wherever they come from. In that moment, I think Ramdas, again, was the one that taught us, if you're actually in the moment, you are ready when they happen, because you're in the present. You're not going to dismiss them, you're not going to run away from them, they happen. And then the eternality of it, the infinity of it, the rest of these words that we don't even know what they mean, comes into focus in a strange kind of way. Mm. And that he knows, he says in that quote, the mystical experience is still a mystery. It's still a magical mystery tour, every second of it. But if you want to ride that horse, you eventually have to break that horse, as it were. You have to not be afraid of it, and you have to invite it in, as Pema says. You know, just allow a bit of that discomfort in, and eventually it becomes much more digestible, and you can transcend it at least for a moment and then do better with your life and other people around you and so on. And so Huxley, I mean, it is remarkable, Raghu, you're right, that he was saying these things. Here's another one.
When is this written? It's like he wrote it in the 50s, probably, right?
Yeah, because he was not really in the 60s that much.
Whenever he got turned on.
I don't know when that happened. When did Ramdas
61?
Really? That are okay.
Yeah.
So that was, it was probably late 62. 50s, which is weird because that's the way it was with Alan Watts also, I think, was that these guys were along with the beatniks, Alan and all of those guys. They were investigating stuff that people didn't even know was there to investigate or was worth investigating. They were doing it all the time. And so Aldous Huxley and Richard Alpert and Tim were not the actual originators because they came a little before, I think. And that's Aldous. In other words, Aldous was already in the full awareness of that upright, carbon-based, biped human beings can actually digest without disintegration. So, Aldous didn't allow it to disintegrate him and loved it. And as maybe it's an urban legend, but as you mentioned before, Raghu, he seemed to have taken it when he was passing, which to me is the most courageous time. I'm not sure I could do that.
And that seemed, I remember directly Ramdas telling us.
He told you that.
Yeah, and of course he was... close to Laura and therefore really did know exactly what was happening in that time. So, just what a tremendous influence. I remember reading Island, actually, when this is the time when I was just searching into the East, little Meister Eckhart, Siddhartha. Book, those were seminal, along with Autobiography of a Yogi, of course. But I've looked back and think of how, God, as a teenager, and not just 13, 14, but, into 16, 17, 18, I was just depressed about the reality of our world and what I was being handed in terms of, you know, you mentioned it all before, you know, the extreme polarization that we were handed by society, parents, teachers, all of it. It was extraordinary, and it made me really quite depressed at that time. And that's when I started looking out. You know, my I have to hand it to him, and thank I did meet him a number of times, Allen Ginsberg, who you knew quite well. But I, you know, and without even knowing him, before I met him, when I was that kind of depressed teenager, he gave me hope. I somehow saw through him that there was a way to go beyond this kind of polarization and the way in which we were being taught how to be more and more self-conscious, really, basically. Yeah, Alan was talking about an upa guru. That's a, you know, that word served him perfectly. He was that, so much of that. But then, so Aldous's book, Island, it so it gives, you know, he created this extraordinary document around how we could be together with each other in a way that transcended our own personal predilections, desires, avoidances, and so on. And it was a dream world to some extent. And then in the end, of course, it all went to shit. Basically, but there was something in it. I remember to this day going, wow, wouldn't that be great? Now, maybe it was Pollyannish to think that, but now I look back at it and go, you know, knowing what I know now after decades of being around these kind of people, and obviously with Neem Karoli Baba, there is a possibility. There absolutely is a possibility for unconditionality, where you're not walking around, what do I get out of this? Or if you don't do that for me, I won't do it for you. That is the way we treat, we experience love. We're taught to experience love in that way, you know, with all of the conditions. And so, yeah, it gave me some hope, that book.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday I was watching the BBC News, and there was a long segment about Moscow and St. Petersburg and the large number of crowds that came out to honor Mr. Navalny, who was clearly murdered. And I was very taken. I was really watching this and looking at the faces of all of these Russian residents and how courageous it was. Because there's no question that they are endangering themselves by just showing that resistance. But there was that feeling there, Raghu, there was that feeling, and several people who were interviewed who could speak pretty good English said, I'm not depressed. I think that this is a turning point. Surely Navalny was a martyr, but the consequence of that is that people will wake up and see that love, because he was really about that. He was about that in his own way. He was about, let's stop the divisiveness within a tyranny as it he saw it. No democracy, no freedom. But these moments when people are courageous and at the same time somewhat endangered, that's a very, very amazing thing. It's a very beautiful thing. And it's beyond anything. It's just they know what's right in their hearts. So they went out and took, you know, a real shot at showing the authorities in that country that there are a lot of us in Russia who are not murderers or fiends, and we're beautiful people, and we're just gonna go out there and protest and show that we have the courage to do that. And I loved it. I just really, and I may not be right on message there, but for me, watching that, you know, was very uplifting. It really was. It was just, oh my God, these people are so courageous. And they know what's what. They know what's going on, and they're just going to say it for a day.
Yeah,
maybe do something about it. And, you know, rather than just suffer and say nothing can be done.
Yeah,
that never works.
I mean, very courageous. Very courageous. Yeah. These people. Yeah. And the way they, you know, the way that you can see they're at one between them, it's like there's the unconditionality in effect, directly in effect, you know. And it was through this man that that happened.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Mm. So we're pretty done here, but...
Yeah, you got one just more?
This is a quote. There are things known and things unknown, and in between are the doors. And that was Jim Morrison said that. And he meant both his band, The Doors, but he also meant in between them are the doors of perception.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Jim Morrison had a volatile life and passing, as we know. But the young die young sometimes. I mean, people die young sometimes because they have one sort of flashing moment to tell us something. And Jim took the name of his band, clearly, from Aldous, who took it from William Blake. That's a pretty interesting sort of chain of consciousnesses that are telling us something.
All right, I have to ask you.
Yep.
Did you meet him?
No.
I never asked you in my
entire... No, and you know,
No.
Yeah, you did. No. Not in Canada. You know, I love The Doors so much, but I never saw them live. And for some reason, but I loved the albums, and they were very deep. They weren't just sort of party pieces. They were stuff about reality in there. And there's no question that Jim Morrison was very aware of the kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. He talked a little bit of John Densmore, who's the drummer.
Oh, yeah.
And I know him because he loved Ram Dass, who he would come to a couple of retreats, and he'd play with Krishnadas. He actually recited the most beautiful poem that he wrote specifically for Ram Dass at that time. We should make that public if it isn't already. Mm. But yeah, he referred to Morrison in a way that he was a real... He was an upa guru for people somebody else. If you haven't experienced The Doors, and I can't imagine many people have not, right? I mean, they're amazing. And they're still somewhere played often, but yes. The Doors are phenomenal.
Yes,
I have
yes.
I have something. I got this incredible book that I was sent called Painting from the Palette of Love, the Mystical Poetry of Kabir. Kabir was an incredible saint from the 16th century, I believe. And of all, the only time I heard Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba, I mean, he would quote or he would make a reference to Tulsidas, who wrote the version of the Ramayana that was the bhakti version. But in terms of the mystic poets and stuff like that, only Kabir. He would make reference to Kabir. So this particular translation is by a man named Thomas Rain Crow, who I think is fairly well known for translating some of these mystics. So anyhow, this is my send-off, because this to me is the most important thing that all of us can engender in our lives. It's called faith. Where are you looking for me? I am with you, my friend. Not in prayers or meditations, not in fasting, not in yogic postures, not in renunciation, not in New Age books or even in the body, and not even in infinite space, not in the womb of nature, not in the breath inside the breath. So seek and search sincerely. It will only take you a second. Kabir says, listen to what I say. Where your trust resides, it is there that you will find your God. That's so great, right? Trust resides. Yeah. There you will find your God.
Mm. Mm.
Good one, huh?
A great one.
Yeah, really great one.
Yeah. I never sort of, honestly, never really put it that way to myself. You know, that's a real light when that happens.
Yeah.
Trust.
Yeah. You know, well, we talk about it a lot in general amongst ourselves over the years, especially with Ram Dass.
Sure.
You know, he has the famous quote when I said, we were talking about trust, and I said, well, when I first met you, Ram, this is up on stage at a retreat. When I met you, when I was the program director of a rock and roll radio station, and I met you, and you just allowed a space to exist where you didn't have any desires, not Richard, not Ram Dass, and it was just, it allowed me to just feel free. And I had so much trust. That trust led me to follow you off to India when you went back in 1970. And I said to him, by the way, what was your first experience of that kind of trust, you know? And he looked at me and he went, mushrooms. Because that experience with psilocybin completely, you know, was altering, as it is for many people. But him being this, you know, psychologist and had been a psychotherapist and all of that, and how deeply embedded he was in the mind, which is why, you know, Huxley was so important to him. He was an icon of the mind, really.
Yeah.
And when this experience that Huxley went through, and then following that, Ram Dass, I mean, that was just absolutely extraordinary. And that began his journey, you know, trust to intuition, we could call it. And I'll never forget that moment. I'm sure Ram Dass didn't either. His own moment around mushrooms. There you go. That's it. That's all we got today.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for being here, Dave.
Oh, it's great. Thanks.
And everybody, we'll have in the show notes, BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. In those show notes, we will link up these books that we've been referring to. We should even put a little something, the Doors, you know, a Spotify thing,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
That would be great. We'll be back. I inveigle David every month or so. I bug him around this. Thank you for coming through. It was my idea. I don't know why I was thinking of Huxley, but I was.
I couldn't think of anything. My mind was just, you know, what do we talk about?
Yeah, but then here we are.
No, it's great because there will be people who say, well, I didn't know about him. Now I'm going to check it out, or I'm never checking it. But at least we have communicated to you something you might not have come across in recent years. That's
And well worth delving into his perspective. Absolutely well worth it. All right, everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And there's a do you know, David, we're going to be debuting? I mean, we've been working on this for over a year. Talks from Krishnamurti that are turned into podcasts.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Because they have somebody who's going to be from the organization that's going to introducing, various talks. They've selected them all. Isn't that so?
That's a big,
we have all your countrymen.
Yeah? Well, you know,
Alan Watts and, well, Krishnamurti wouldn't
I
be.
I did meet Krishnamurti.
You did?
I did. Yes, I did. I went to one lecture at the university that I went that he gave. And there are two things I remember about it. It was in 1965, I think, or something. And he was the best dressed person I think I'd ever seen.
The best dressed guru.
He was ridiculous. He looks like a Paris model for older men. And at a certain angle, and my friend who was with me agreed with this, he looked like an old Paul McCartney.
Really?
There was something about his profile, his eyes or something. There was something. But then again, the talk that he gave was one of those amalgams of total compassion and total objectivity. So it wasn't at all mystical. It was about how do you live on this planet and how much of this other stuff do you need to know in order to do it. He was totally amazing.
Yeah. Anyhow, so everybody look forward to that. Hopefully, just at the beginning of March 2024, I'm hoping within the month that will happen. So check it out, BeHereNowNetwork.com. And thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
See you next week, everybody.